Very good evening to you again. Thanks for coming out tonight at a busy time of year and in such wintry conditions. We are continuing, as Alistair mentioned, in Esther. And if you have a Bible, we are going to be reading tonight in Esther chapter 6 and 7. You'll find that on page 505 of the Red Bibles, 505. We'll pick up the story from where we left off last time in chapter 5, but tonight we'll read chapter 6 and 7 in a moment. If you remember Frasier, the sitcom, the American comedy, the Dr. Fraser Crane in Seattle and his brother Niles, a favourite of mine. Or you might more recently have seen a programme called Miranda, which has been on. Programmes that are both quite similar, really, in their premise. I suppose, theatrically speaking, they would both be classified as farces. That is, they are programmes or plot lines that rely on the most improbable coincidences or misunderstandings in order to carry the story along to set up the particular incident or dilemma. So while they are very funny, the stories themselves can feel almost ridiculous. And as we move into the heart of Esther, into chapters 6 and 7 tonight, there is something of that kind of feel about what we're going to be reading. We are going to be reading about a chain of coincidences and misunderstandings that lead to really comical, almost farcical situations. The result being that some commentators, some people who have come to the book of Esther and studied it, have dismissed the book as fiction. They have suggested that the book of Esther can't really be historical reality because it's just too unlikely to be true, too improbable when you read of all the different things that come together as the story unfolds. But sadly, I would suggest such a view of the book of Esther is actually to miss its entire point, the real message of the book. I noted last week that Esther famously stands out of all the books in the Bible as the only one in which God is not mentioned. And that isn't an oversight, but rather the author is making a very intentional point by not mentioning the name of God in this Old Testament book. Because this is a book about and would originally have been for a people who are away from home. Remember, the Jews like Esther and Mordecai in the Persian Empire are living in a pagan society far away from the promised land back there in Israel. In Israel, they had been surrounded by reminders of God's presence. At the center of national life in Jerusalem was the great Old Testament temple, the dwelling place of God among his people, the place where God made his home in a very special way at the heart of that nation. But in the Persian Empire, where the only temples were pagan ones, God perhaps felt a little bit more remote. Where was Israel's God now? What of his promises? Could they still rely upon his care? Their world was now one where it could just feel that their God was just a little bit less real than he had been. It was a world in which the majority of those around them knew little and cared even less about Israel's God. It was a world where to be a follower of God was to be in a minority, was to put yourself out in a limb. To keep faith with Israel's God in Persia was to be different, was not to fit in. And so the book of Esther, in a very literal way, describes a world where on the face of it, God appears to be absent. But in between every line, unseen in every page, the writer is drawing us inevitably to the conclusion that God is at work. Esther is a book that reminds the people of God that God is at work in the lives and circumstances of his people, even when he appears not to be. Even when we wonder, where is God? Where is the evidence of God? Has he moved away? God is there. It's a great pastoral reminder to us as Christians living at the turn of the 21st century in Britain. To be Christians living in a place where to follow Jesus is to be different, is not to fit in with the majority. A place where Jesus Christ is not honoured, but is increasingly marginalised or disregarded. A society perhaps where we sometimes wonder, where is God? Has he abandoned his people? Have his promises, have our great hopes been let down? Are we doomed as Christians, as a minority of believers in the Lord Jesus Christ in our country, just to be at the mercy of godless leaders and godless laws and godless agendas? Esther reminds us that the invisible God is present, is in control, is working for his people, that even in the apparent randomness of life, God knows exactly what he is doing, that even in human sinfulness and folly, God is working out his good purposes for his people. So let's read then in chapters 6 and 7 and pick up the story of Esther. We left off in chapter 5 with Esther having gone to see the king and asked him to go to a banquet the following day in which she would make her request on behalf of the Jewish people. But in chapter 6 we read, that night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who had guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honour and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. His attendants answered, Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honour? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honour than me? So he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honour, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honour and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honour. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honour. Afterwards Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh his wife and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisers and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And as they were drinking wine on that second day, the king again asked, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. And Queen Esther answered, if I have found favour with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing?" Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this vile Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs attending the king, said, "A gallows 75 feet high stands by Haman's house. He has made it for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king." The king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman in the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. This is the word of God. So Esther has gone in to see King Xerxes at the request of Mordecai. Xerxes had extended in chapter 5 the golden scepter, this token of mercy to her, and asked her what she wanted. And rather than immediately raising the issue of this decree to destroy the Jews and making that request that the king might overturn it in some way, she instead invites Haman and Xerxes to a banquet. And actually at that banquet, she then defers the request again when Xerxes inquires of her what it is she wants to a banquet the following day. What is going on? Is Esther perhaps getting cold feet, having second thoughts about raising this issue with the king? Well, I don't think so. We know, don't we, from what we just read, that she does raise the issue. But Esther, in those first initial circumstances, is showing great wisdom in her approach to what is obviously a very delicate and important issue. She is preparing the ground for the right moment to speak to Xerxes about it. And we see in the book of Esther that Esther, as well as being a woman of great courage, is also presented to us as a real model of godly wisdom in action. In contrast, Haman, on the other side, is put forward really as somebody who represents all that is vain and proud and foolish. The contrast between Esther and Haman in these passages gives us a host of illustrations about the way of wisdom as opposed to the way of folly. One of the books that I try to read quite regularly, not as often as I ought, is the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs in the Bible, which follows on through this series of books, which are sometimes called the wisdom books in the Bible, is of course God's wisdom for everyday life, full of practical, godly, common sense, spirit-inspired wisdom for how we handle situations, for how we deal with others, for how we deal with our own sensibilities and impulses. Proverbs is God's wisdom. And if you aren't a regular reader of Proverbs, if you haven't read Proverbs for a long time, if you have never read Proverbs, then let me very humbly suggest to you that you probably are lacking wisdom in your life right now. It's a book that you need to read over and over again, once a year minimum, I would suggest. It's been pointed out that the book of Proverbs rather pleasingly has 31 chapters, one for every day of the month, to keep us going. There is no better insight into human psychology that you will read than the book of Proverbs. And one of the lessons of wisdom in the book of Esther in the life of this woman is that wisdom waits. Wisdom doesn't blurt in. It doesn't jump the gun. It doesn't rush to judgment. Proverbs 25 verse 15 says, "Through patience a ruler can be persuaded, and a gentle tongue can break a bone." Esther is taking her time just to build up and to re-establish this key relationship with the king. She is establishing a favourable basis for making this request. In the community over the last year, Andy Lloyd Williams, our community worker, among other things, has been patiently building up relationships, building a basis for long-term engagement between the church and those who live round about us, doing things like running football clubs in local schools, just providing an activity, showing goodwill, building up relationships, serving without strings, so that when an opportune time comes, as he is praying, and we should be praying for him, then there will be opportunities to perhaps take that a step further in terms of our gospel ministry in the community. It is a pathway of very practical, godly wisdom in how we engage with others. In personal relationships or conflict points, wisdom will always seek to build up relationships where possible. It will give thought to the best time when to raise a difficult issue. Christmas is a classic time of family conflict. It is one of those pressure points where it is just so common for there to be arguments or disputes or fallouts among people who are suddenly thrown together in quite an intense way at times with lots of pressures upon them. And so we need some wisdom as Christians, as people who are going in to the holiday season, as we were reminded this morning. Wisdom will bite its lip. It will count to 10. It will defer raising an issue. We don't have to take the matter of where the Christmas tree goes to task there and then, or fall out about the number of Brussels sprouts. Let's use Christmas, this great opportunity, to strengthen relationships, to build up our friendships and our family bonds, and not to weaken them. So wisdom waits. It waits for the opportune time. But we need to push on, because in contrast to wisdom and to Esther, we have Haman, this very different character with a very different approach to life. In chapter 5, Haman leaves the first banquet feeling very happy with himself. Chapter 5 and verse 9, Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. And his mood is only spoiled by the sight of Mordecai at the king's gate and Mordecai's refusal once again to bow down or to give him homage in some way. But he goes home, we read in chapter 5, and he gathers his wife and his friends together in verse 10. And what a colossal bore Haman is. I mean, what a nightmare to be stuck in a room with this guy. Haman boasted to them, verse 11, about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honoured him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. What a night that must have been to sit with Haman. Two quick lessons from Haman in these verses. Firstly, notice that there is a root of bitterness in Haman's life. Because here is a man who on the face of it has abundant blessings. He has a greatly privileged life. He is extremely well off by the standards of any society, never mind back in the Persian Empire. He has a wife, he has children, he has friends who gather round, he's got plenty of money, he's got a good job, we would say. He has so much to be thankful about, so much to enjoy, but he is not a happy man. Verse 13. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. There is one thing in his life that really niggles and eats away at him, Mordecai. It's funny, isn't it, how one small thing in our life, relatively speaking, can infect our whole outlook on our lives, our whole perception. one difficult person at work, maybe even in the church, one unresolved issue that consumes us, that seems to rob us of joy in every other area. Now, some of these issues can be significant. I'm not just trying to trivialise all these things and say, well, they don't matter. But for Haman, that one thing became a root of bitterness in his life. A root of bitterness that ultimately ruined him. And we need to watch for this, don't we? Where might we be in danger of such feelings? You see, the New Testament sees bitterness as not something which is just out there, but actually can be a real threat to Christians, to believers, to followers in Jesus Christ. The New Testament writes of it in various ways, at various times. Ephesians 4, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Get rid of all bitterness, rage and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Hebrews 12, see to it that no one misses the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. James 3, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbour bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. And the antidote to bitterness is in these verses as well, isn't it? It is in humility and in forgiveness. Two commodities that it seemed that Haman was bereft of. I wonder if there's an awareness in your life tonight of a stubborn and perhaps growing resentment towards somebody or over some issue. Then the Bible is calling you tonight by the Spirit of God to confess it, to humble yourself, to seek to forgive whatever offence you may feel it's been caused against you. And there's no better way, no more practical, evident way of humbling yourself in such things than to confess it to somebody else. It's a real test of humility. Because like a weed, as it was in Haman's life, unless it is uprooted through confession, through prayer, through seeking forgiveness, it will spread and it will leave an ugliness in you. For Haman, this bitterness would lead him to plot the murder of somebody else. But it was a bitterness that would lead ultimately to his own humiliation and destruction. And so let's learn from Haman's root of bitterness. But secondly, we see in Haman a man who is utterly self-obsessed and consumed with vanity. Haman comes to us in the book of Esther as a very extreme example of it, of course. With him, his vanity, his ego was so public as to be embarrassing. And of course, such boasting, such kind of self-promotion is usually a sign of a much deeper insecurity, that need to prove to others how important and significant and valuable you are, that deep-seated fear of what other people might think about us if they were just left to make conclusions based on their own observations without us telling them and spinning it and giving them a bit of self-promotion. And again, we need to learn the lessons from Haman. Haman isn't just there as some kind of caricature of some kind of absurdly corrupt man, but he is there to warn us and to represent the things that the Bible would call us to turn away from, to be careful that they don't become characteristics in our own life, however embryonic, however small, at this stage, perhaps. I think for all of us, we perhaps will never get to the stage, hopefully, of being as blatant as Haman was in his neediness and his self-promotion, but it is a lurking danger for all of us, isn't it? The need to explain to others just how good the school is that your children go to. The feigned amazement as we talk about how much more our house is worth now than when we bought it. Thank goodness we won't have to hear that maybe for a while longer. The publicising of ministry successes and the silence about the flops. You see, to the extent that we need to self-promote in that way, to the extent that we need to make those points and promote an image to others, is the extent to which we are man-focused rather than God-focused. Because our security, our sense of self-worth, our sense of value, our sense of peace about ourselves needs to come from God's view of us rather than other people's. That knowledge of the love and the care and the plan for your life that Jesus Christ has should overshadow everything else. So what if some people don't know about some success you've had? God knows. So what if some sacrifice you have made has gone unnoticed in Greenview? God knows. So what if you have been unfairly represented in some quarter? God knows. Because of course the problem with people is that they're fickle and unfair and insecure themselves. So there will never be any rest or closure or peace in chasing after their approval. Only when we are content to let God be our judge. Only when we are content, well, God knows the truth of the situation. God knows what I have done or what I haven't done. He knows my heart. Only when we are content to leave these things with God will we actually find peace and security in our lives. And Esther again stands out here in great contrast to Haman. Go back to chapter 2 for a moment. In chapter 2 we were alerted to the fact that there had been a plot, an assassination plot against Xerxes, which had been uncovered by Mordecai. And in chapter 2 verse 22 we read, "But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai." You see, whereas Haman is full of self-promotion, Esther is giving credit to others. She could very easily, in her position, couldn't she, have spun it to get the glory herself? We could just imagine the way that you might do that. You go to Xerxes and say, "I have become aware of a very serious situation and I feel very strongly that you should know about that." And the "I" is very prominent in the way it's presented, and Mordecai and others are pushed to one side. Well, your part, your perhaps very minor incidental part of the situation is very much inflated. I've sat in Christian committee meetings, sadly, where credit hasn't been fully given where it was due, where the ideas or work of people have been claimed by others, where one person's part has been trumpeted while others are glossed over. But Esther isn't like that. And in God's wisdom, he is saying, be like Esther. Don't be like Haman. And thank goodness Esther isn't like that, because it is her integrity in giving credit to Mordecai that becomes a key part of how God works to deliver his people later on. Colin Powell, the American general, he was Secretary of State under George W. Bush for a period, but probably came to prominence in the first Gulf War, says in his autobiography, "It's amazing what you can achieve when you're prepared to let others take the credit for it." It's It's a good word of wisdom there. In one sense, of course, he is meaning that if we have an idea, but we're prepared to let other people take the credit for it, then we might actually see that idea being realised. But in another sense, in a more biblical sense, we can see that giving other people the credit is actually something that God perhaps will use all the more in terms of working out his plans. Well, in chapter 6 and 7, don't worry, we're not going to go at the same rate through chapters 6 and 7. We're going to really conclude by a few observations. We get this series of coincidences, as we read in our reading tonight, all these amazing, slightly bizarre circumstances that heap one upon another. So we started off, didn't we, in chapter 6 with the king can't sleep. So happens, maybe Esther's pending request is on his mind. Maybe he's so intrigued about what it's going to be that that's keeping him awake. But anyway, he gets the royal records read to him. Obviously thought that would be a good cure for insomnia, to get his administration logbook read out. And among the records, it so happens, is read out the incident when Mordecai exposes the assassination plot. And Xerxes thinks, well, this man, Mordecai, should be honoured. Has anything been done? No, nothing's been done. Right, get me an advisor. And who should appear just at that point? Haman, who's come fresh, of course, from his little huddle with his wife and advisors, hoping to get Xerxes' approval to get Mordecai hung, in contrast. And then, of course, there's a misunderstanding, because the king says to Mordecai, what would you do to somebody that I wanted to honour? And Haman, being ego man himself, thinks, well, who else could he be talking about other than me? And suggests this great elaborate robing up and horse parade around the city to great acclaim, only to find out that it's actually for Mordecai, and he's now got to go and lead the horse. So we have the first part of Haman's humiliation. And then he has to then go back from that to the second banquet, where Esther breaks her silence and Haman is confronted, chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. And as the king tries to get his head round all that's now suddenly been disclosed about how Haman has plotted the downfall of the Jews, including Esther, he storms out to get some air, it seems, to get his head around it. Haman is now pleading with Esther for his teetering life, and as he grovels in panic round about her, he falls onto her couch just as Xerxes returns in, and it's game over for Haman. He's bundled away, his face covered, to be hanged on his own gallows. It's all breathtaking stuff, isn't it? As Haman's schemes and duplicity unravel in the space of a day, leading to God's people being vindicated. There are few examples, I think, of such a concentration of providence, if you like, even in the Bible. And yet it is God's providence that runs all the way through the Bible. From the very beginning in Genesis, through the lives of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, through the wilderness experiences of God's people, through the earlier kings of David and Solomon, through the divided kingdom, through the exile itself, God's providence is writ large. God is working out a story here. God is leading his people to the destination that he wants them to get to, even to the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that same providence runs through our own lives. Sometimes remarkably, sometimes improbably, it seems to us. Augustine, one of the great theologians of the Christian church, trying to find meaning in God and life through all sorts of pagan dead ends. And he's wrestling with his conscience in his garden one day, when over the wall, somebody is reading, as he would have done in those days, aloud from Romans, and a light bulb goes on in his head as the very verse that illuminates and makes clear to him what he has been lacking in his life all those years is suddenly announced anonymously over the wall. Martin Luther, with that burden of sin and never being able to do enough and to have his conscience appeased before this great holy God that he has understood but hasn't begun to understand the mercy of God. And a thunderbolt crashes beside him, even as he walks home one night, that brings him to his knees, unleashing the Reformation in his life. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, one of the great preachers of the 19th century. The preacher hadn't turned up because of the snow. And so some kind of not very able local bod is pushed into the pulpit and repeats a sermon which is really pretty weak by sermon's own admission. But in that stumbling, amateurish lay sermon, Spurgeon finds salvation. God's providence. When I was preparing to go to Bible college about, my goodness, 10 years ago now, almost, and over that summer was preparing to make the arrangements and trying to raise the support and wondering whether we would be able to do it and whether we would get the finance, which is a big thing, always is, of course, in these areas of life at times. And I was getting the train into Glasgow Central, commuting to work over that summer. And on the train at one of the stops, one or two people from Greenview used to get on. And it so happened on one occasion, another guy got on who I didn't know. I know him well since. And one of the people from Greenview says, "How are the arrangements going for Bible college?" So I'm trying to explain a little bit about, you know, preparations. And I'm aware this stranger is there sort of in the conversation and feels a bit ignorant that we're having this private conversation. So I turn to him and say, "It's just that I'm going to go to Bible college this year, hopefully, and we're having to make these arrangements and obviously raise support." And he says, "Oh, I'm the treasurer of a Christian foundation that supports people going to Bible college. Maybe I could help you with that." When our third child was born, he was delivered by cesarean section, and it was a planned section. And that morning we were quite stressed, as you are. You know, it's a routine operation in many ways, but those are the sort of operations where the risks might be low, but the stakes are enormous. So you're inevitably feeling a little bit anxious about it. And I know Jessica, my wife, was as well. And we're sort of praying, and it's on your mind. And I walk into the bathroom, and there's a bit of cardboard in the bathroom. And I pick it up, and it's a bookmark, and on it is Psalm 121. "No harm will come to you. The Lord will watch over you." And I think, well, where's that come from? It's not mine. I take it through to Jessica. Never seen it in her life before. Don't know where it's come from. Now, I don't think it's supernaturally materialised on the carpet. But we've been given a bunch of second-hand books that had been sitting in the hall. And I think probably what had happened was it was in one of them. And one of the kids had pulled it out that morning. And as they do, walked around the house with it and then just dumped it in the bathroom. And picked it up. And we held on to that bookmark all day. And when Peter was taken away because of breathing problems, Jessica sat with it in her hand in a hospital bed. Just coincidences. No significance. Just statistical quirks, happy chance. Well, perhaps if we are, as some would suggest, no more than just a bunch of highly evolved apes clinging to a dying rock, spinning through an empty universe, then probably that's all they are. But you see, in the book of Esther, we see that this world is not a world of fluke, not a world of hope for the best, randomness, but this is God's world. Overseen by a God who is working without a momentary lapse on behalf of his people, working to work out his plans of salvation, of redemption, ultimately of a great, glorious future, a new creation. Last Sunday morning, we thought how Joseph and Mary were 90 miles away from Bethlehem as Mary gets to the time of childbirth. How would Micah chapter 5 be fulfilled? Would God perhaps send another angelic messenger to blaze into the room and to say to Joseph, Joseph, get yourself to Bethlehem quickly. Perhaps he would send a fiery chariot to transport them across. No, on that occasion, just at the right time, Augustus Caesar calls a census. God does, of course, work through miracles. But for the most part, he is working in the ordinary events of our lives, in the mundane, everyday, unfolding schedules of this world. And Esther is a great reminder to us as the people of God that whatever our circumstances, God is at work in them. He is at work in our lives. Sometimes Jesus took his disciples into a place of danger, into the storm. Sometimes he took them into the place of great glory and blessing up the Mount of Transfiguration. For the most part, they were just walking and talking as they went through those years of discipleship. But Jesus is always the guide.